It's Tuesday, January 25th, and the Supreme Court is going back to school. We start here. By agreeing to hear a new case, did the Supreme Court just signal the end of affirmative action?
This has always been a very divisive issue, both in the country and on the court.
Why a simple addition to the docket is sending shockwaves through colleges. American troops are not battling Russia, but they are battling these guys.
ISIS is still a force to be reckoned with.
The alarming siege in Syria as ISIS tries to pull off a jailbreak. And Bitcoin trading is complicated enough. Try opening up a Bitcoin mine.
So we're talking thousands of dollars every day from these computers.
That's right.
Why a 21st century industry is prompting 19th century questions. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Something really important to know about the U.S. Supreme Court is that they don't have to accept every case they're requested to hear. That would just be too many cases. They're perfectly within their rights to say, yeah, the lower court got it right, or there's plenty of precedent, there's nothing to see here. That happens most of the time. Obviously, they're going to settle the big groundbreaking cases about a brand new law or a concept that's just never been argued before. As for the rest of the cases, the ones further off the radar, often, if justices say we would like to hear this one, that means they've got something to say.
The Supreme Court's interest in taking this case is a strong suggestion that there may be a majority on the court for overturning those precedents.
Well, yesterday, the most conservative Supreme Court in generations officially said it will hear arguments over cases that some had considered settled law, cases involving college admissions, students of color, and whether certain colors are given preference. ABC senior Washington correspondent Devin Dwyer covers the Supreme Court. Devin, can you just walk us through the details here? Because several lawyers looked through this yesterday and said, oh, we've kind of seen cases like this before.
Yeah, for decades, Brad, the Supreme Court has said repeatedly in a number of cases that the use of race in college admissions is allowed as a factor among many that schools use to really advance that goal of ensuring a diverse student body. In fact, the schools have long argued that if they're not able to look at race, they can't create an educational environment that is rich for students and for really future American leaders.
Making the future a place where people are not only well prepared to work together, but they come to understand the diverse lineages that they come from.
And the court has backed them in that endeavor, what Justice Kennedy called an intangible goal, something that he saw as important to give schools a lot of leeway in developing that plan. It was 2016. He wrote an opinion affirming, again, the right of affirmative action on college campuses. Well, enter 2022. We have a very different looking Supreme Court, one that is increasingly emboldened and unhindered, Brad, toward revisiting some of those precedents. And that's why yesterday the justices announced in a much anticipated set of cases that they will now take this up and look again at affirmative action on college campuses.
Some admissions officers referred to Asians as a kind of homogenous group, all very similar.
Describing Asians as
quiet, math or science oriented, book smart.
Test-taking robots with no personalities.
So these cases, Brad, were brought by a coalition of students called the Students for Fair Admissions, a group, roughly 20,000, they say, Asian American students. And they allege that Harvard and the University of North Carolina discriminated against them on the basis of race in denying them admission to those schools.
Based on my understanding, I think the fact that I'm Asian American plays a pretty big factor into why I was rejected.
They say this was illegal. They say the policies of these schools have benefited Black and Hispanic students at the expense of Asian American and white students.
They use the holistic admissions process as kind of like a weapon to balance the, I guess, the makeup of Harvard.
They're really familiar arguments. These are arguments that opponents of affirmative action have advanced for years, but they are back, and these students hope that they find some success with this conservative court.
ODMA's mission is to create an inclusive community where all students can grow and thrive. Our goal is to open those gates up so that more people can enter.
The schools, for their part, defend the policies, saying race is not a sole determinant, of course, for letting in any students, but rather one factor among many, which is what the Supreme Court said holds muster when it comes to the Constitution and federal law.
Well, and so if schools have looked to the Supreme Court for guidance on affirmative actions, like we saw cases like in the 70s, and then you said again, like 6 years ago, what makes this case different and why is the court taking it up now?
Well, every single one of the court's affirmative action decisions in favor of affirmative action, Brad, was decided by just one vote. So this has always been a very divisive issue, both in the country and on the court.
What Harvard is trying to do today with its diversity initiatives is to include groups that were excluded in the past.
The idea of the Civil Rights Act was that the state should not discriminate on the basis of race. Doesn't matter, you're doing it one way or another.
Of course, one big reason is the makeup of the court, but the other is the orchestrated effort of conservative activists on a whole number of issues, Brad. We've been talking about gun rights, abortion, religious liberty, all of those things percolating up to this court for the first time. This is the first time affirmative action is coming before the 6-3 court, and that's because of activists like Edward Bloom. He's the man behind Students for Fair Admissions, a longtime opponent of affirmative action, who's led challenges to the high court before.
The raw number of Asians applying to Harvard and Yale and Princeton had gone up significantly over a 20-year period, but the percentage of Asians admitted stayed the same.
So because of slavery 200 years ago, and because of Jim Crow, and because of segregation, today we have injustice based on race.
The stakes are significant. In fact, there was just a study done, Brad, out of the University of Washington in conjunction with the Brookings Institute, which took a look at 19 public universities across 9 states that have banned the use of race in admissions. And they found that the representation of Black, Latino, Native American students on those campuses plunged after those bans took effect. So it's sort of on the precipice right now. And there's a lot of concern that just the fact that they took this case signals that policy could be coming to an end potentially.
Yeah, we talked before about how certain cases that we've seen recently, like on abortion rights, have almost been word for word in contradiction with settled law. And experts have said that's the whole point. You're handing this case to a more conservative Supreme Court so that specifically when they rule for you, everyone will be in agreement that an old precedent was just tossed out and a new one is in place. Devin Dwyer in Washington. Thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, tensions are building in Europe, but bullets are flying in Syria. Why Americans find themselves caught in a firefight after the break. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Have you ever wondered what you would do with an extra hour in your day? I think about this all the time. I'm like, I would be so productive. I'd exercise more, or I'd read a book, or I'd take a nap, like restore myself. We often find ourselves yearning for these extra hours, but the real question is, what would you do if you were making yourself a priority? Well, how about therapy? It can help you discover what's important so you can make the most of your time. If you've ever benefited from therapy, you know how transformative it can be. It's not just for those who have experienced major trauma. Therapy empowers you to learn positive coping skills, set boundaries, and become the best version of yourself. If you're considering starting therapy, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, and tailored to your schedule. You just fill out a brief questionnaire. You'll be matched with a licensed therapist. And here's the beauty of it. You can switch therapists if you're not finding the right fit. No additional charge. Take the first step. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/start here today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/start here.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
We've talked talked a lot about the potential for an invasion of Ukraine in recent days. And yesterday, in a significant development,
the United States has taken steps to heighten the readiness of its forces at home and abroad so that they are prepared to respond to a range of contingencies.
The Pentagon placed thousands of U.S. troops on heightened alert, and President Biden is said to be considering deployments. But as all those hypotheticals are unfolding, the U.S. is already actively involved in another conflict where our military has actually made airstrikes in recent days. ABC's foreign correspondent James Longman is with us. And James, this is about ISIS in Syria, right? I feel like a lot of people talk about ISIS in the past tense in Iraq and Syria. What's happening there?
Well, that's very much not the case, Bradley. ISIS is still a force to be reckoned with, and this was their most daring attempt yet since the 2019 so-called fall of the caliphate, when on Thursday they launched an attack to try to break out other ISIS fighters from a major jail that holds ISIS fighters, 3,000 of them, in northeastern Syria. It was a sophisticated attack. It saw thousands of ISIS fighters and suspected supporters inside this jail rise up, coordinated with those on the outside. Something like 200 fighters on the outside of the jail try to break in. And for days now, there has been a fight.
Hundreds of jihadists have escaped, with most of them being recaptured, but some are still on the run.
In this detention center, there are also up to 700 boys, some as young as 12, who were former caliphate cubs. But now the ISIS fighters are using them as human shields. And so this sophisticated attack has carried on now for days, and it's developed into a siege. 10,000 SDF, that's the Syrian Democratic Forces, a mix of Arabs and Kurdish forces supported by the United States, have been laying siege to this prison in an effort to try to get those boys out.
And for the U.S., then, what kind of involvement are we talking about? Like, what has it been thus far, and what could it be if this escalates even more?
Up until now, the United States has been very proud to say that they continue to support their allies on the ground in northeastern Syria through airstrikes. Now we have had it confirmed that U.S. troops are on the ground actually at this fight, at this prison, involved in this siege.
We have a photo of an American chopper that intervened. This means that the fight is intense.
We should say that it's very unlikely that special forces will be going into the prison to storm it, but we've had it confirmed from the Pentagon that armored Bradley fighting vehicles manned by US personnel are at the prison, actually blocking off certain entrances and exits. And I've had it anecdotally from the ground that these vehicles have taken fire and they've responded, although all these sorts of reports are very, very difficult to verify. The bottom line is American personnel are on the ground, and it would be a very, very big prize for any ISIS fighter to either capture or kill an American service member. So they are very much on the front lines of this fight in Syria.
Well, and that's my final question, James. Say all this is totally successful for ISIS, right? Say all these prisoners do get freed, these other groups have to kind of retreat from the whole thing. What does that mean for the continued, I guess, revitalization of ISIS in the region?
Well, this is the bottom line. The situation at the moment, the status quo, is completely unsustainable. This is just one detention center. We're talking about 12,000 men and boys who are thought to be affiliated with ISIS in detention centers across the region. A further 80,000 men, women and children living in subhuman conditions. The families of ISIS are living in camps, again, across the region. The Kurdish-run SDF are basically saying, we cannot be responsible for all these people. We do not have the infrastructure. We cannot continue to guard our own tormentors, which is what they were. Don't forget, the Kurds were the ones who suffered the most at the hands of ISIS.
Locals forced to run for their lives, fleeing artillery fire. Officials now warning of a humanitarian disaster.
And a big, big issue is, of these 80,000 men, women and children, of these 12,000 fighters and supporters, a large, large number are foreign. They're not even from Syria or Iraq. They're from 50 countries around the world. The United States has been pushing these other countries to take responsibility for these people, to put them through a process to repatriate them. But a lot of these countries have been unwilling to do that because you bring them back to their country of origin, it's a very unpopular decision.
Prisoners not going back to his countries where the countries don't want them. And this creates a situation that their actions like here, right now, starting.
This is the status quo as it is now, but like I said, it's completely unsustainable. And things are only going to get worse because the conditions for radicalization and extremism are being left to fester. And if they get much worse, we're going to see ISIS re-emerge again and again and again.
Yeah, right. There's a downside to any politician saying, yeah, let's bring back terrorists, alleged terrorists, into our country. It's perhaps bigger downside to saying, let's have there be some lawless area for terrorists on the other side of the world. James Longman reporting on all this in London. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brad.
At the opening bell yesterday, it appeared that five straight days of stock plunges weren't enough. The steep downturn stretched into this week, but an afternoon rally saved the day. And you think about what all this volatility means for the average person. You think about retirement accounts, pension funds. But throughout the last several years, more and more people who are not necessarily rich have sunk more and more of their savings into investment opportunities like cryptocurrency.
I've mined Bitcoin on my PC from December to January.
Dogecoin. Where my dogs at?
Now today, the crypto went dip.
The thing is, when you buy into these cryptocurrencies, you're really taking a chance on two things. One is the price fluctuation. The price of Bitcoin has been an even steeper roller coaster than stocks lately. But the other risk is just the concept of the thing. Adherents believe Bitcoin is ushering in an entirely new concept of money. And like any industry, whoever owns the raw material will be kingmakers of the future. So, ABC's Elizabeth Schulze has done something that not many other people have done. She visited a place recently where Bitcoins are made, or to use the correct phrasing, where they're mined. Elizabeth, could you just walk us through what you found here?
Well, Brad, that's right. We got this rare look inside a Bitcoin mine in Pennsylvania. And in the same way that there is money to be made from Bitcoin that we've seen investors pile into the cryptocurrency, there is also money to be made in mining Bitcoin. So how this works, we know that Bitcoin is a type of digital money. Basically, it can only be exchanged online. It's gotten really popular because of this idea that it's not regulated by any one government or central authority, and there is a finite number of Bitcoin that can be created in the world.
Like to have a regular currency, you want to have some idea of scarcity, and so the Bitcoin creators made this like mining process.
That's right. There is a finite number of Bitcoin that can ultimately be created in the same way that there is only so much gold in the world, for example, and you have to actually mine this Bitcoin in order to create it.
So this is the Bitcoin mining operation right here.
That's right.
These are the miners, the computers. We're not talking about people. Computers.
That's right.
So how this works, there are computers all around the world. They are basically working 24/7 to create Bitcoin by solving complex math puzzles.
We're checking trillions of combinations of numbers, trying to find one unique number that will unlock the blockchain.
And the first computer that successfully processes these puzzles is awarded in Bitcoin. So basically, as we've seen the price of Bitcoin go up, there has been more money to be made in mining Bitcoin, in creating Bitcoin.
So that particular machine will get about $30 a day on average.
So how many computers do we have here?
We have around 10,000 right now.
So we're talking thousands of dollars every day from these computers.
That's right.
Now, there's a huge cost here associated with that, like we see with any industry, and that is that there are other side effects required for all of the power that's needed to get these computers running. And that's what we're seeing a big debate around in Pennsylvania and, frankly, around the world right now, Brad.
I will say to you that we're not perfect. We do emit carbon. However, it's offset by the carbon and other toxic materials that are emitted from these piles. That has to be weighed into that formulation.
Well, it's interesting that this is taking place in Pennsylvania then, because you think about the history of Pennsylvania industry, you think about mining and what that has meant for communities, what that's meant for jobs and prosperity, and what's that meant for the, you know, surrounding environment. So it sounds like some of the same alliances and battle lines are being drawn all over again.
Exactly. So the facility that we visited is burning waste coal, which is not the same thing as coal. It's a type of unused coal that's been discarded after decades of coal mining in Pennsylvania.
Every ton of this material was brought up from a mining operation underground. It's 200 feet deep, 175 acres worth of mine tailings.
And it's burning this waste coal to keep the Bitcoin mines running.
We found a way to utilize the power generation of the plant, that old school technology with the brand new supercomputer technology that's employed to mine cryptocurrency and Bitcoin.
So old and the new right here in the same place.
Right as we stand is the synergy of the old world and the new world right here.
And it's loud. These, you these are working overtime.
It is. These are computers that are just designed to do one thing. They're designed to run as fast as possible 24 hours a day.
It was fascinating when we were there, Brad. You could hear these computers processing so much. It's almost like when you listen to your laptop start to overheat and the fan starts running and it needs to cool down. They also have fans that are needed to keep these computers cooled because of how much power is needed to keep them going. So there's just a lot of electricity needed because of how much computing power is going into this operation. You know, one estimate from the Cambridge Center for Alternative Finance found that annually global Bitcoin mining uses more electricity than the entire country of the Netherlands.
Bitcoin in general is wasteful by design. It doesn't need to be. Even if you're going to do cryptocurrencies, if you're going to do blockchain technology, there's other alternatives that aren't as wasteful as Bitcoin.
So this has raised a lot of questions and concerns from climate activists who say, look, there's this whole industry that's popping up that is emitting more, that is using more energy and electricity at a time when we are trying to cut back carbon emissions as fast as we can right now.
Well, I'm still hung up on this point of view that burning coal is actually good for the neighbors, Elizabeth. So if you're one of these Bitcoin miners, there's already just enough risk in investing in this stuff. Where do they see their role in this emerging industry?
So this was what was really fascinating about this story, and I think is lost in the general dialogue about cryptocurrency mining. There are plenty of power plants that were coal mines before that have been revived to simply power Bitcoin. And understandably, that is not good for the environment. But there's a little bit more nuance behind the scenes here.
And I will tell you, we're making the best of a bad situation.
We talked to the entrepreneur who came up with this idea of mining Bitcoin using this waste coal as the power source.
I grew up in one of these communities. I grew up playing on one of these waste coal sites. It's an environmental nightmare. It's misunderstood, mischaracterized. People don't really know they exist unless you grew up in these communities.
He says that these piles of waste coal that's really been kind of abandoned across the state are a major source of pollution that leach acid into streams. They pollute the air.
And that particular material, I feel, made me sick with cancer. My father had cancer. My grandfather had cancer. And I'd like to eliminate that environmental impact on our community.
Well, they're not removing pollution. They're moving pollution. They're moving pollution from the land and they're moving it to the air.
On the other hand, you, of course, have climate activists, and we talk to them, too, who say burning waste coal to power Bitcoin is not the future. We should not be going back to a previous power source in order to fuel something, even if it is a currency of the future. If you might believe that, this is not the solution.
Really, the only good solution it would be to remove it, move it to an appropriately permitted lined landfill.
But that costs money, and the money is not there right now.
Yeah. Well, it costs money, but subsidizing waste coal costs money.
And so really, it's kind of this microcosm of a new industry meeting the same problems that an old industry encountered and trying to determine if it's worth it to help some communities, but also essentially moving some of that pollution from the ground in the form of this waste coal, for example, to the air by carbon emissions.
Yeah, you got so many people in this country right now putting a lot of their trust in Bitcoin. The question, I think, for a lot of people is, when will this become a currency that a lot of people actually use versus just kind of a very ephemeral investment opportunity? Mining, though, getting more of those coins into circulation, I guess, is a big part of that solution. Elizabeth Schulze, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Brad.
Okay, we're going to take one more quick break. When we come back, forget the jobs of the future. This employer wants to offer you a job straight out of the Middle Ages. One last thing is next.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
And one last thing. For so many around the world, the pandemic has presented a turning point for their careers. Well, recently, the newest nominee for most sought-after job on the planet has sprung up on the northwest coast of England. Local government officials are asking for someone, anyone, to take over a small island named Pyle.
Far away from the hazards and claustrophobia of modern city life, let's take a boat to Pyle Island, just off the Lancashire mainland at Barrow-in-Furness.
For three centuries, Pyle has been a summertime tourist attraction for people looking to explore ruins.
If you like solitude, you couldn't wish for a better spot, for there are only two landmarks on the whole island, and one, the ruins of this early 13th century castle.
As the new custodian of Pyle Island, you'd be in charge of those ruins and everything else on a 50-acre island. Of course, when tourists are visiting, they need a place to stay, so you'd also be running a 300-year-old inn, complete with the island's only pub. Things cool down in the winter, leaving the custodian the only human being for miles. For years, that was Dan and Sarah Rooney.
Today, the island's only permanent inhabitants, a husband and wife, live alone in this rather different home.
So why, you might be asking yourself, would this ever be a desirable job? Isn't this custodian innkeeper thing giving off major Shining vibes?
You've always been the caretaker.
Well, for one, in a world of telecommuting, this is the ultimate work-from-home job. Two, since you'd technically be taking on a lease, you could make a nice little profit if you lure enough guests. And most importantly, you'd be a monarch.
Dan, a former policeman, is also traditionally known as the King of Pyle Island.
In a ritual that goes back at least to the 19th century, this island's custodian is given the title King of Pyle Island, complete with a helmet, a sword, and this anointing ceremony that involves alcohol poured on your head. This is not just a tradition, by the way. This is literally covered in the paperwork that comes with your lease. Oh, and there's one other thing to keep in mind. If you do want to be the next king or queen of the island, think about your life post-pandemic. The lease runs from this April and then continues for the next 10 years. Hey, what are you up to when you get off work tonight? Oh, you know, I'm just chilling with these haunted ruins next door. No one to hear my screams. Oh, cool. I can't wait to visit you there. Smart speakers, by the way, will always talk to you. Don't forget, we are smart speaker friendly. If you want to cue us up, you can listen to us every morning. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.